A podcast of the cinema, hosted by...
Oh, you're going to do that.
Yes, okay. Because you always run roughshod with it.
All right.
You are Dave White, film critic for The Wrap and Man About Town.
Are you going to introduce yourself, too, using a...
No, I'll
are you going to steal it
I'll
all do, away
I'll,
from
yeah,
me?
Yeah, why don't I?
Go ahead, do it.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm film reviews editor at The Wrap, co-host of the Breakfast All Day and Who Shot Your Podcasts, and this one that you are listening to right now. That's how that
to
works.
To answer the question... Guest, he does this, he does two others, and then he does three more
for our Patreon
for our
subscribers.
This guest has how many damn podcasts is about to do?
Constantly doing a podcast.
It's true.
Is Alonzo Duraldi.
We're all sick of the sound of my voice, including me.
No.
I hope not.
Everybody likes the sound of your voice.
I just want to say that your theme music... could also be one of those sort of Reservoir Dogs-esque, like, protracted violent scenes where the
ironic
music...
Ironic,
yeah.
I've always thought that the minute we got that theme song, that the implied violence of the name Linoleum Knife for a film podcast and happy, upbeat children's chorus theme song was a nice... fit.
Sinister.
I always liked it.
Contrapunto. Yeah. So you know this from reading the title of the episode, but our guest today is the great Guinevere Turner.
Woo! Oh, yay, me.
Whom we have known for 75 years.
Yes.
75 years. I really did meet you in 1994 in Dallas, didn't I?
No, here. Actually, I was living here in 94, and I interviewed you and Rose by the pool at the Beverly Hilton when you were doing press for Go Fish.
Right.
Please tell the people her many accomplishments.
Oh, good heavens. What haven't you done?
Well, I got a Razzie.
What, for Blood Rain?
Yes.
Nice.
I was just
How
on,
dare they?
I was just on a Larry King Now, which is airing tomorrow, and their guest host, because Larry's getting surgery, is Tom Green. And Tom, I was like, how can I? And he's being very serious, which I just find very, I'm like, I'm going to get Tom Green. And I Googled him a lot, and I was like, oh, you know what? We're going to Razzie bond.
You both have them.
You got four Razzies for Freddy Got Fingered.
A fave of Dave's, actually.
Blood Rain and Freddy Got Fingered are films I unapologetically love. And I will not have any discussions to the contrary.
In addition to your Razzie, you have starred in and or co-written such classics as Go Fish, American Psycho, The Notorious Betty Page. You were from the OG The L Word, which is...
the greatest television show that has ever existed.
Oh, wow.
Not only a writer, but Gabby DeVoe.
And I just always like to brag that I actually made up the title of The L Word.
Really?
You're welcome, culture.
Yes. Oh, so because of you, they didn't call it Earthlings after all?
She knew, Eileen Shaken, who created the show, knew that didn't work. And we were like down to the wire trying to figure out what the title is. And I love coming up with titles. Same thing with my film, Now Charlie Says, down to the wire coming up with the right title. It's my favorite thing. Go Fish as well.
We have been, from its beginnings, I wouldn't even call it low-key obsessed. We have been high-key obsessed. With the L Word,
I did not know this about you too.
It's true. L Word home.
Yeah. So, who's, are you a Bette? Are you a Tina? Are you Shane? Like, who are you?
Dawn Denbo.
Yeah, Dawn Denbo is our god.
Elizabeth Keener.
We quote her constantly.
Her lover Cindy.
her beautiful lover Cindy. You, I don't even know who you are, but you're going down too.
Yeah, there are. It's a quoted. Series.
And I have shown more people the Angela Robinson phone tree intro to that one episode where it's like all the phone calls coming in and out, and it's all about Shane's premiere tonight. And it's like, I think it's just one of the great moments of television.
And also, fun fact, Angela Robinson created Gabby DeVoe, the character that I play. And I'm wondering if they're going to bring Gabby back for the reboot.
I was going to ask you that.
I would, because I wouldn't necessarily want to write on the show, but I would sure drag old Gabby out of it. I would dust her off in a heartbeat.
Well, thoughts and prayers, and write your congressman. And yes, you are, of course, now currently the co-writer of Charlie
Sole
Says.
Sole writer
of Charlie Says, which is in theaters and streaming, so you have no excuse not to see it. An extraordinary new movie about three of the women involved with the Manson cult and their, I guess, deprogramming? Is that a...
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of not what the woman set out to do, deprogram mm-hmm. them, but that's sort of what happened.
Which is one of the things that I love about the movie, because, and we're, of course, going to get into your extraordinary New Yorker essay about your own background with cults, but I love... Like one of the movies that I watched constantly as a teenager on the movie channel in the 80s was this Canadian film called Ticket to Heaven. Do you know this movie?
No.
Nick Mancuso plays a young guy who gets drawn into this sort of Mooney-style cult, and his family kidnaps him so they can deprogram him. I believe there's a young, what's her face, Sex and the City. Kim Cattrall is in it.
I love Saul a young Rubinek. Kim Cattrall.
Yes. Meg Foster with the eye thing happening.
I want to see that movie, especially because in real life in the 70s, late 60s and 70s, there was a man named Ted Patrick who was considered the father of deprogramming. And there's his story is so interesting, and the sort of controversial nature of kidnapping people and deprogramming them and how that eventually became illegal.
Oh, wow. Well, so what I wanted to ask you, though, is like, as somebody who has had firsthand experience with that kind of thing, do movies ever get it right as far as whether either what life inside the cult / commune is like or the leaving of it?
What I've seen, although maybe Ticket to Heaven, I'm going to watch it, is good. The only movie that I've seen that I felt got close is Marcy May Marlene.
Oh yeah.
Which I thought did a pretty good job. But it's even that one still, there's still this like, ooh, this is the only way I could describe it, you know, like, ooh, cult. And you know, we've always been that way as a society.
Right.
And I mean, you can't help it. My movie is like that too. It's like, ooh, weird, creepy. You just can't help it. But I tried really hard to get as far away from that as I could.
You definitely, I think, demystify Manson in a big way. I think it's very easy to make him this sort of like savage messiah, you know, and he's kind of a dork.
That was to me one of the most important projects of the movie, was to take him down a notch in terms of, you know, people just think like Charles Manson is what the embodiment of evil, and he just wasn't all that. Like he was not a good man, and he was very good at manipulating people, but he was also like had a sweaty desperation and wanted to be a rock star, and would have been
a failure.
He was a failure
at what he was wanting to be.
It's a very LA story that way.
Yeah, for me I really wanted to sort of point out, A, you should really don't thwart artists. Really bad thing happened. Hitler. And second, there's this idea that if that man had gotten a record contract, all those people would be alive. Like it's kind of so embarrassing in a way. You know what I mean? And to me, once he knew he wasn't going to get that record contract, he had to whip something else up, because he was terrified that his followers would leave him. And so that's when he flipped into like full on revolution, helter skelter mania. And I've never really understood what exactly, how much of what he said he truly believed. Or if he just slowly started to believe his own hype because people were still there listening to him. I never really understood that. I talked to Matt Smith, who plays him, a lot about that. But what do we, like, at what point do we think he's bullshitting, and at what point do we think did he really believe that they were going to, you know, live in an underground cave, and that that black people were going to take over and then ask him
to then leave them
to help them?
Do we think that when someone is attempting to, you know, build their own personal mythology in the hope of influencing others and keeping what they've brought, you know, to themselves, that if sometimes you can tell a lie to save face or to get out of a situation, and then it really works, and the lie, you repeat it, and then eventually 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road, telling people that lie so many times, you start thinking it really happened. You start thinking it's true.
Yeah.
And especially if there's, I mean, clearly there was mental illness involved with this man.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, con man, I would say for sure, but maybe one who really believed his con.
When I thought about it, I started to think about two things. Because I was trying to answer the question, how did he get these women to do this? No one's really ever kind of answered that question, you know, in culture that I've seen. You know, people just sort of thought, like, sort of put the blame on them, like, well, they were obviously crazy. It's like, you know, they were just normal people who got, for various reasons, were vulnerable to this. But I thought to myself two things. One, I started doing research, and I was researching human traffickers, people who, because I've always also been perplexed, like, how do people get that sucked into that without seeing all the warning signs of what's happening? And so I read this thing that really stuck with me, and I really brought to Charlie, which is this contemporary human sex trafficker guy said, here's how I do it. When I go to a mall, I insinuate myself into a conversation with a bunch of young women. If I tell a girl she has pretty eyes and she says thank you, I move on to the next one, and I keep going until I get to the girl that I say, you have pretty eyes, and she says, no, I don't, and that's my girl.
Right.
Isn't that chilling?
It is chilling.
Yikes. And I really wanted to. I put that in the movie, sort of, that he picked vulnerable women who had something in them that they just needed to be told that they were beautiful, and then he would tell them that, and then take it away. And all of that just replicates, sort of, domestic violence, abusive relationships, sure, narcissistic personalities. It's just on a grander scale. And so I was thinking also about the kind of people who are manipulative in relationships and isolate. It's usually men to women. Sorry, men. and I just thought, oh, those people, those kinds of people who are manipulative in relationships, also just tell lies in the moment to get what they want and to manipulate. And like you were saying, I think they sort of believe it. You right. kind of have to believe it a little bit.
Right.
I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I needed to lie about stuff, I would, on the first project, convince myself that it's true and then sell it.
is that how you act?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I need to, like, believe it in your bones kind of thing, you know?
One of the things that I dug in the movie, but I've also seen, it's popped up in, like, Roberta Gregory, who's a cartoonist who did the Bitchy Bitch comics, who's a lesbian. I love these, when we look back at the sort of the hippie era where, you know, there's been this sort of gloss over it for years, like, oh, yes, love and understanding and blah, blah, blah. But there was such a sexist patriarchy within that structure. Like in the New Yorker piece, you talk about, you know, going back to the Lyman family and realizing that, oh, the women are doing all the actual work here and the men are pushing them around and the men are picking out their child brides and all that stuff. And so even in these communities that we think are supposed to be sort of, you know, elevated or progressive or whatever, it's the same crap that you're seeing everywhere else.
Yeah. And it was interesting too to, I mean, that is how I grew up. And that is that a lot of the sort of countercultural movement of the late 60s and 70s still had these really traditional gender roles. And it was interesting too, once Mary Harron came on, the director, because she is older than me and she was a teenager when these murders happened. Oh. And she said she remembered at that time, like that she's like, you had two choices. You could either be a sexy, like free love, have sex with everyone lady, or you could be the earth mother with a flower in your hair cooking bread. And she's like, I was neither of those things. Mm-hmm. And so she also brought, I think, her own kind of rage at, you know, that this sort of fake freedom that that was touted in the, you know, during that time. And I think she was also thrilled that I've somehow managed to bring in early 70s feminism. I was thrilled. I mean, I didn't make any of that up. There was a review recently that said, you know, having the woman pull out, you know, Sisterhood is Powerful and Our Bodies Ourselves was a little on the nose. I'm like, mister, it's on the nose, I guess.
Because but this is what happened.
This is actually what, literally these books. Like, it's not, like, I wasn't being heavy-handed. This is what happened.
Yeah, this is reportage.
Yes. I mean, the thing that makes me laugh, too, is that you know, when they, the producers, you know, talked to me about writing this movie, first of all, they talked to me about writing this movie because of American Psycho. And I was like, hold up.
Right.
That's the least of why I should be writing this movie, because right. I grew up in a cult, basically. And, you know, that was this amazing moment of like, I never known that I had a job so immediately in my life, and probably never will again. They're like, okay, yeah, it's totally you. You're totally hired.
You're good in a room moment.
Yes. I'm like, I'm just meant to write this. But the thing with, so, but all they said was, we want to make a movie that focuses on the Manson girls. And so as soon as the ink was dry in my contract, I'm like, we're never saying Manson girls again. They're not girls. They've been in prison for 45 years and they're not his. They're like, uh-oh, angry Jack alert. Too late. You hired me. But I what amazes me to this day, so I, you know, got into the research and like dug in and, you know, spent months reading all the things and watching all the videos and, you know, just scouring things, microfiche even, to look at sort of like, you know, alternative weeklies from LA and blah 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 in, you know, around that time. And I found finally Carlene Faith's book, which is a lot of, she was the woman who worked with them in prison,
right.
Played by Merritt Weaver in our movie, amazingly.
Who's so good.
So good. We love Merritt Weaver.
She's ever since Nurse wonderful.
Jackie, I've been totally on board for
yes,
her.
Yes, I was so excited. But what's funny to me is that somehow I found a lesbian in the story, because even though she says in the movie, she says she's not a lesbian. Uh-huh. In real life, she was just waiting for her last kid to turn 18 so she could come out. She knew she was gay. Wow. She just had this husband who she didn't want him to use it against her that she was gay. But she was, the second her kid turned 18, she was out, and she was out for the rest of her life. Mm. And she sadly she passed away 2 years ago, so she didn't get to see the movie. Or Merritt play her, which she would have loved. But I became friends with her.
Oh,
and I spent a lot of time with her up in Vancouver where she lived, and we talked on the phone a lot. And it makes me really sad that she didn't get to see the movie, because I think she would like it.
Well, I think dig into any historical event enough and you will find a list.
Right. Holding a copy of Sisterhood is Powerful. Really? She really did. I was like, sweet, I found a lesbian. And then Mary, you know, there's a shot in the movie where she's opening up Our Bodies Ourselves, and it's just all these sort of drawings of vaginas. Mm. And Mary did that just for me. I didn't literally, like, on the page, it didn't say she opens the book to drawings of vaginas.
I mean, yeah, I think, like, the first time I really had read anything that was remotely sort of compassionate towards these women and their experiences was probably like John Waters' essay about Leslie Van Houten in his book Role Models. And it was like, yeah, we have sort of demonized all of these people with the same brush. And it's like, there are levels of culpability and there are levels of, you know, who was in charge and who was, you know, goaded into following along. And,
right.
You know, and so I think it's great that we're talking about this stuff.
It's interesting that you bring up John, because I know John. We've just been on panels together in at gay brunches. and Mary and John are actually pretty good friends. And when he heard that we were doing this, he wrote Mary like a furious email. How can you do this? And you know because, and I sort of didn't quite understand this, that, you know, making any movie about these crimes is not good for them, parole wise which is why
that's been his thing. I know,
like, which is why at the end of my movie there's a thing on the screen that says that they had nothing to do with this movie. But John was, he's like, don't, you know, how can you do this? And then Mary's like, do you want to read our script? read it. And he was like, oh, okay, I see where you're coming from. So we have his blessing, but we did not at first.
No, I could see where he'd be sensitive about that.
Listen, there was a film that came out earlier this year that I refused to see.
Oh, yeah.
The Sharon Tate. Thing. The Haunting of Sharon Tate.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. I know that I sort of need to see it, because it's part of the conversation of all these quote unquote Manson movies that are coming out right now. But I've heard that it's unbearably terrible.
That's what I've heard.
And the premise of it is, as I understand it, so thin.
Yeah.
Because one time maybe Sharon said, you know, I feel like this house is haunted, but she her sister was like, she was kidding. Like, it's like, she didn't, you know what I mean? Like, that has nothing to do with anything. Like, she didn't have premonitions about her own death. Like, she was just living her life.
There is so much in the culture about this group of folks. And, like, more so, I think, than any other well-known cult. they have become abstract in a way that allows for their inclusion in popular culture, for people to pick and choose whatever they want to hang whatever they want on.
Yeah.
You know? And so I remember very distinctly in the 1980s, in sort of the punk and metal, you know, subcultures, a fascination, a generalized fascination with serial killers and with like murderous cults, and especially with Charles Manson.
I mean, Marilyn Manson literally was being cheeky and let them made that stage name. It's like, not, it's not cool, bro.
So there's this amount of acceptable exploitation.
Yeah.
Of not just
the Geraldo Rivera interview.
Not just the people involved.
Oh, I remember
involved.
It well. What the hell's a hippie cult leader? We taped it and would watch it over and over when I was in college. We were obsessed.
Yeah.
In a funny way, in an ironic way, in a way that I now take it all a lot more seriously. I mean, you know, in the 90s, I feel like, or in the late 80s and early 90s, people had like serial killer, you know, playing cards. And
yes.
You know what I mean? It's like actual people died.
So it was this amount of acceptable exploitation across the board. I mean, Krenwinkel, the first name.
Patricia.
Patricia Krenwinkel. It was a joke on an episode of Gilmore Girls. And and that's a strange place to find that.
Right. You know?
And so I remember moving to Los Angeles and being fascinated by the fact that there is a museum of death.
Yeah, I know. People are like, have you been there? I'm like, what?
Oh, I went there.
Fun fact about me, I don't like scary things.
Yeah,
I don't like scary movies. I don't like, they're like, you know, Manson's like guitar is there or something. And I'm like,
well, there's a Manson room.
Yeah, I'm like that.
And there are crime scene photos.
Ah!
And on that day, every bit of ironic distance that I ever had about it changed because I walked in, I just sort of wandered into the room and I was like, oh my God, I'm seeing crime scene photos. And I had to leave.
I hated the day that I had to really study the crime scene photos and read everything about the, you know, the literal blow by blow of both of those crimes in order to write about them. I have a really hard time looking at crime scene photos in general,
right.
You know, and then being like, okay, I have to write a scene. How do we get here? It's a dark place.
Yeah. And so what I love about this movie is the care that has been taken with representing flesh and blood human beings to the world.
Mm.
And there's this idea of humanizing people in films that's always interesting to me. Like they often start from the premise, especially if the characters are based on real people, that this is a monster, right? And we have to figure out a way to give them enough human traits so that we see them as something else. Not as a monster, but kind of almost like a human being, like you and me.
Right.
Which in turn leads people to then accuse the film of being, you know, monster apologetics. And so there's this, it's a real tricky.
But it's also, it's easier to think of people like that as a monster.
You correct.
Don't have to, if they aren't human, then you don't have to consider what it is about humanity in general that can lead to that kind of behavior or instinct or whatever, you know.
So but what this film does is start with the premise of these are regular young women who were taken in by essentially a con man with this weird combination of
delusions of grandeur,
charm and delusions and love in quotes, but it's more like a wooing, you know, whether he understood what he was doing with them.
Yeah,
or
he's
not.
He's like, grooming them basically in the way that we come to know that word now.
Right.
As far as like, like you were saying, it's like finding the one who doesn't think her eyes are pretty. You
know, right.
That's the
thing. And so and doing it, you know, Mary always quotes me. I love when Mary quotes me. She says when she said like, "How did he do it?" And I just said, "Step by step." And I used the frog in the pot of boiling water metaphor, which is if you throw a frog in a pot of boiling water, it'll jump out. But if you put it in lukewarm water and then slowly turn up the temperature, it'll just die.
Yeah.
That's my deep thought.
I wanted to ask you about Mary Harron, because like you literally started in like kind of lesbian collectivist filmmaking in Chicago with Go Fish, and now one of your like great ongoing professional partners is a straight married woman from Canada. How does that partnership work?
Oh my God, Jimmy's horrified to be described that way.
She's so a lot of other things
those
too.
Those things are all true, but
I don't want to be reductive. But how does that partnership work? And like, I mean, like, how did y'all meet in the first place?
Funny story, actually. So her first film was produced by Christine Vachon. I shot Andy Warhol, right. And my first film was produced by Christine Go Fish. And so we met literally at the Groucho Club in London, where she was having a meeting with Christine, and I was staying there doing press. And so we just sort of met. And one of the first things Mary Harron ever said to me was, "You look like Betty Page," and I said, "Who's Betty Page?"
Oh, wow.
And then, like, you know, like 5 years later, she's like, "Have you read American Psycho? It would be a great movie." And I'm like, "What's American Psycho?" Thank God. I'm like, thank God for Mary Harron. I don't know what rock I live under. I didn't know these two things. But then this time.
I know. I'll go to Guinevere. She will have never heard.
She'll have a really fresh take.
But you got to initiate this one.
But this one was me. And this is the first one that we haven't co-written, where I wrote it and then she came on as a director later, which has been a really interesting new dynamic for us and a great one. Because, you know, a lot of screenwriters, once the director's on, they don't have a lot of say in what happens next. And I was literally on the set every day, you know, rewriting, talking to actors, talking to production designers, like, you know, cause I had all these years of research and she was catching up on, and she just trusted me. I mean, it was fantastic. So she lives in New York and I live in LA. But we really work best when we're in the same room. Mm. So we just make it a point to come
meet in Chicago.
No, either come in here or there. Usually in one of our homes, so we can have, you know, endless snacks as part of our process.
I like that. I respect that.
And we've already written a fourth script that's ready that we're raising money for.
Great.
Yeah.
Nice. And now you've directed, what, 7 short films?
I think I'm at 7, yeah.
And do you want to do a feature? Is that a thing that you, is that on the bucket list?
Or? Oh, absolutely. Not the bucket list. This in the next 5 the years. Hopefully I'm not going to die in the next 5 years. No, absolutely. I feel like the way in for that, for someone with my level of experience, you know, it's a huge leap and I'm not a man. So we don't get to just like have huge leaps. Like, oh, she looks like she knows what she would.
How
be
dare
doing.
You?
Is that I'm working on creating a TV show. Oh. Then I feel like I, you know, if I surround myself with directors like Mary, and she's going to direct, I can then direct on a TV show, and then I can be like, look, I can do it. Can I make a feature now? So that's my plan. I have a plan. Like that's literally like what's going to happen to me in the next few years is I'm going to have my own TV show and I'm going to then show my chops as a director. I've directed these shorts. I feel I can do it. All you do is surround yourself with people who know what they're doing and be a good leader. All of that I got covered.
Yeah. Well, you eliminated a question I had for you, which was, you have always seemed to do your own thing. How? Because so many people don't get to do their own thing. But you just answered it. You have a plan.
Yeah, I do.
You've always had a plan.
I always have a plan. And to be honest, I sometimes really just feel super lucky. I feel like I sometimes am very right place, right time. You know, like I feel like, for example, Go Fish, it just like it was such a confluence of the moment, you know, where indie film was, where the world ready to have a real look at sort of lesbian culture.
Hey, a new queer cinema film that's not going to depress us.
Right. Yeah. And
you guys were like a lightning strike at that moment, because I was living in Texas. I was a school teacher. I had these other gay male friends. Go Fish was the first lesbian movie any of them had ever given a thought to watching.
Hmm.
And we went to the local art house theater and we're like, we're going to watch this movie. I got in trouble for suggesting it after it was over because, well, it's gay men in the early 1990s.
Right, they're like, just like,
no more lesbian movies.
Yeah, like, who are... Right, they're like, what?
Haha, well, it's too late. They got your money.
Yeah. It's like, wait, that's a lot of women talking. Yeah. That's like way too much women talking. It's funny because I had never written or read a screenplay when I wrote that screenplay with Rose Trochet, the director. And I remember saying, I mean, how hard can it be? People walk into a room, they say things, and then they walk out, which is hilarious because it's a little harder than that. But also, if you see the movie, you're like, oh, that's what this writer was like. That's how movies are. I'm like, thank God they're sex scenes to break up my idea of how to write a screenplay. And Rose's experimental film sensibility that makes it feel not like just a play, I guess. I don't know I was thinking.
It's very good banter and then like swirls of half and half in coffee. You
right.
Know, it's my kind of movie. In the plan, is there still acting for you, or are you more committed now to the other side of the camera? Do you want to be able to hop back and forth?
Oh, as always, I would love to be able to hop back and forth. I really, really love acting, and I've only gotten better at it. I guess that's true. That's the great thing about getting older. You're just theoretically, you just get better at the things you do.
Yeah, we don't get better at podcasting.
No, we're still, the audio is awful.
I would love to continue to act. I've written something with a different director that I work with, Jane Clark, which is a horror film that stars me as a very successful romance novelist who goes off her medication and is losing her mind. And then everyone that comes over, she kills. And the movie's called Don't Come Over. And so it's genuinely a horror movie, but it's also, it's like Repulsion kind of.
Oh, sure. Yeah, right.
But it's starring me, and I just really, really, really want to.
And y'all previously collaborated on
Crazy Bitches.
Crazy Bitches, yes.
Yeah. So I'm really hoping that we can raise money for that, because I mean, don't you want to see me like in a nightgown going insane for 90 minutes?
Yeah.
I would want to see you in a lot of films, but especially this one.
I begged Mary Harron to let me play the warden in Charlie Says. Like, begged. And she was like, no one is going to believe you. It was the warden of a women's prison. So I'm like, I'm an actor. You're just so used to me being me. Like, I'm like, I'll get a bowl haircut. I'll wear sensible shoes. Like, I'll do whatever. And she's just like, no. And as I would say to her husband, like, when she's sleeping, can you like whisper in her ear? Like, Guinevere should be the warden.
Although y'all did get Annabeth Gish, who's awesome. Yeah. And my of course question is like, did you pester her with questions about Shag? Because I would have.
No, I was like a fan of her because she was from the X-Files.
Oh, right. Of course.
Yeah. And you know what I have to say about Annabeth? She naturally has a posture that is like, she clearly, I asked her actually, did you study ballet? And she said, yes. She naturally has this sort of permanent, like completely elegant, completely upright posture that I couldn't do if I tried. And I think it works really well for the warden that she just has this kind of formality.
Erect.
About her. Yeah. But I do, I realize now that, so I was in American Psycho and Mary was fine with that, obviously. But I realize now, she never said it, but I realized that actually having me in the movie would be distracting to anyone who knows us. Do you know what I mean? Just a sort of like a stunty thing that might take you out of the realness. And so I accepted it, but I still was like, I want to be in the movie. You know, and I also, because I was originally supposed to play Betty Page.
Right.
But then I just got too old. Like, it took us a really long time to make that movie. And that was a heartbreak, but, you know, I accepted it. The filmmaker in me accepted it, even though the actor was crying. So I was like, but can I just play her sister? Like, it's just a really small part. She was like, no, everyone's going to be like, why didn't you cast her? So we have a history of Mary saying no to me. In the new one that we wrote, is there anyone? I don't think there's anyone I could play. It's teenagers. We're really excited about the new one, which is called The Highway That Eats People, because we for once in our damn lives, it's not a period piece.
Ooh,
so we don't have to worry about all this. Our world, it can be whatever we want. We don't have to get anything right.
The wigs.
Yeah. We're excited about that.
You know what? And this is a harsh household about period wigs. They were quite good. In
yes.
Says.
Yes.
Mary was really, she hates a bad wig too. Mm. And she was adamant. And there was a point during pre-production where she was like, do you need this bald, this shaved head scene? Like, do we need it? She's like, do you know what this is going to take time-wise? Mm. And I was like, can I please have it? Because it's so iconic and it's true. And just that, like that, and the moment, like it's nothing, it sells the moment visually. Like they're back to square one.
Right.
But that was a long day to get it right. I mean, all those women genuinely have really long hair.
Right, right.
The other thing that was in pre-production, I was in a pre-production meeting and the AD was like, all right, kids, how many kids do we need? And I was like, we need kids. And he's like, we don't really need kids. They're not really part of that. You know, how many kids can we get away with having? And I was like, can we please? And then I was like, why am I so upset? I'm like, oh, because it's me. Because that's me in the story. I was that little kid. Yeah. And then they were like, chickens. What about chickens? I was like, please don't take the chickens. I want chickens. And Mary's like, I just work with chickens. I don't want any chickens. They're a nightmare. And I was like, no, no, chickens. There's no chickens
Such
in the movie.
Divas,
I had written
chickens
in. No chickens, no kids. And they were like, what about horses? I was like, don't take the horses. We got to have the horses. It was a ranch. I was like, they were like, okay, you can have a couple horses.
Yeah. I mean, it's like an old Western set. Like, yeah. How could you not? Please. All right. I know you got to go, but we are delighted that you could come in. The movie, as Charlie says, it's in theaters. It is available on Amazon and iTunes and all the streaming places.
Also iTunes, yes.
And your piece in The New Yorker is called...
In the print, it was what I called it, which is The Others. Of course, online it's called My Childhood in a Cult, which is a little on the nose for me, but I guess they know what makes people click.
Sometimes you got to go with the highway that eats people. You got to just get to the chase. Anyway, must reading, an amazing piece. And where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot. And weirdly, I'm Turner Guinevere because someone else has Guinevere Turner and never tweets. Sometimes I tweet at them and say, why are you being so boring with my name? So that's not me. It's Turner at Turner Guinevere. I'm also on Instagram as Guinevere Turner, Facebook, blah, blah, blah.
When you Google this name, I come up, right. Not you.
Who are you?
I know. It's like whoever has at linoleum knife also never uses it. Drives us crazy.
Like, I'm like, can we bargain? Like, or do you want money? Like, it's so weird. So anyway, I'm not a huge tweeter, but I try.
Fair enough. Well, congrats on this movie. It's awesome. We always love seeing you. And good luck on everything that's on the list.
Oh, yes. See me in 4 years, see if I've accomplished these things.
Oh, we're circling back.
Okay.
Listen, we follow you, so we're keeping track of the plan.
Thanks, you guys.
And we're back.
She's gone now.
Yes.
We can talk about her behind her back.
And her little dog, too.
And her little dog, too. The cutest little dog.
Oh, adorable and so well-behaved.
Yes. They've only been a couple for 6 weeks, apparently.
They've pair bonded.
She came in and she curled up on a pillow on the living room rug and took a little nap. Sweet doggy.
Yes.
I didn't touch her. Super allergic.
I made to pet her a few times, but she was not particularly interested. So
get your dude hands off of her.
Yeah.
Her body.
My dog's body, myself, you know.
I adore Gwen Turner so much.
She's extraordinary.
Like, from the moment you introduced me to her, I take constant delight in her company anytime she's around. And she is the person who delivered a life lesson to me one day.
Oh,
well, yeah, because, like, you know, you live inside your own body and you don't see how the world sees you.
Oh, I remember this.
and I mean, you look in the mirror and you think, I'm very nice. I bake a pie. Like, I do have the experience of, you know, walking down the street in broad daylight and having women cross the street to not walk past me. Mm. This has happened to me in my life. Less so now that I'm older. I think I look a little like
grandpa.
I look more like an ineffectual late middle-aged man now. But I remember saying that to her. I'm like, what is it with ladies crossing the street to avoid me? And she said, well, you're just going to have to stop raping us. And then she said, not you. And I was like, oh, okay. I get it. That makes sense.
Yes.
But yeah, she's fantastic. We've been doing this show for 9-ish years, and this is the first time she's been a guest.
I know. I'm a little appalled at myself.
Mind blown. It
never
by
happened
that.
Before.
Yeah. Anyway, we are now going to move on with film criticism reviews.
Yes.
We're
reviewing criticism.
We're going to start reviewing other critics.
God help us.
I've got a few I could review.
No, I'm sure you could.
I've got a couple in my head who need a little reviewing. little thumbs down.
Think of the blowback.
Oh, please. I don't care. I just don't care. Maybe someday there'll be a show where I just name names.
Oh, do not.
Like the last one we ever do. Like this podcast ever comes to an end.
But before the killer meteor comes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I'll just be like, all right.
I got nothing to lose.
I got nothing to lose. Here's who I'm at for the takedown. And they deserved it for decades, or at least moments.
We love all of our friends in the film criticism world.
Oh, yeah. If you're my friend and you're a film critic, you're safe. The rest of you, though. You don't know what I think of you yet, do you?
I don't want to know what people think of us, so.
It's true. I don't want to know what anyone thinks of me.
It's
frankly.
A fair trade.
I'm like, look, just, I'm trying my best exactly. to not be the worst person alive.
That should count for something.
John Wick 3, Candle Delirium is a film. There's a store. There's a candle store in our neighborhood.
Yeah, appropriately enough.
You say appropriately enough. How in the hell does a candle store stay alive?
With the name Candle Delirium?
In the cutthroat world of West Hollywood businesses.
Storefronts? Good yeah. question.
Storefront business, you know, relies on the foot traffic of people coming in. And they not only have they been around for a long time, they expanded into the next space.
Well,
their name is Candle Delirium.
Here's the thing.
And they're, you know, I bought candles there before.
People
but
like.
I just am fascinated by how they stay in business.
Can I try
Everything
to answer your question?
Gets shut down here all the time. Please do.
People like a candle.
I love a candle.
People want to go in person and smell that candle first.
Yes, they do.
You know, like people who buy shoes online, I don't understand.
Candles are the same as shoes.
You do not want to buy a candle online unless it's one that you already know that you like. But you want a face full of it first.
Yes.
And I imagine because candles are kind of a foofy item that the markup is substantial. Just a hunch.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. There are candles out there that are like $100.
Yeah.
Or more.
Yeah.
$100.
Yeah. For scented wax.
And strings in it. And they may have like a burn life of 60 to 80 hours, but that's still more than $1 an hour for a candle.
A dollar? Are you Canadian all of a sudden?
Did I say it that way?
Yes.
That was not my intention.
Sorry.
Anyway, yes, sorry for saying dollar.
You're being obnoxious.
John Wick 3 is a parabellum.
Oh, God. I never thought about John Wick 3. It's like those candles with the three wicks in them.
We're only amusing ourselves at this point.
I had people over and I shelled out. I got the John Wick 3.
Parabellum.
Yes.
Parabellum. That means...
Prepare for war.
The preparation for war.
Yes.
I thought by this point, the war was already in full swing.
They're just getting warmed up.
Ain't it? This is the third John Wick movie. What have we been seeing in these three films if it ain't already war?
I'll tell you, I enjoyed John Wick 2. Don't remember a thing about it.
Not much.
So when this movie picked up right as John Wick 2 ended, I kept thinking, is there going to be a flashback where they explain what's going on? I'm like, oh no, because we're just picking right up. I just don't remember what happened in that last movie.
Right.
I enjoyed it. I liked John Wick 2. Just flew right out of my head.
I enjoyed John Wick 2. I enjoyed OG John Wick.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed John Wick 3.
I like John Wick 3.
I like that John Wick. He's... an enigma. But what I mean by that is...
He's played by Keanu
Reeves.
We
are very ever rarely given any sort of information about who he is. We know things he's done.
And we get some dollops of backstory here. We find out that he was like raised in the Belarusian mob or whatever.
Yeah, we found that out in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which makes perfect sense because why else would he be... embroiled in their business and all their blood oaths and
coins
that they have to present, and their little catchphrases like I have served, I will be of service,
or
something like that. Yeah. And apparently there is something in the Belarus that turns everyone who comes near it into a death machine. Like, the ability to fight and punch and kick and stab and kill and crush and do, you know, all kinds of violent acts, mano a mano or with guns.
Library books.
So skilled. Hang on, we'll get to that. So skilled with guns that someone says, you're going to have to shoot me to make this look like it was an accident. Can you do it just here and just here? And John Wick's like, bang, bang.
Yeah, without hitting this artery or
that
artery.
Yeah, did it. I'm so precise.
These movies, I think there's this idea that in the 21st century, audiences might be turned off by this level of mayhem if it wasn't a sort of self-contained universe. Like, everybody who is shooting at each other is part of the shooting at each other world that this movie is creating.
The shooting at each other community.
Yes, this underground. I think on Breakfast All Day, I was like, these are all like hired assassins. Do we ever see them kill somebody who isn't another hired assassin? Maybe they have in the past, but in these movies, they're just, it's all internecine.
You're right. Everyone in this film is part of the murder community.
Yes.
And they spend most of their time going after each other.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the plot.
John Wick is excommunicado.
John Wick is a killer who is a sentient machine gun. Like, he is a gun that talks and wears a suit.
He's not just a gun.
He's a gun that talks and wears a suit.
He can be stabby.
His fingers are also little guns. And his feet are knives. And so, like, there's all, he can do anything to you with any part of his body. Mm. Oh, the other part is also a gun. So he can do that to you too. So, but yeah, we've had movies about talking cats, about talking dogs, all kinds of, you know, but never about a talking gun. And this is a film about a man who is a gun that talks. The high table, the secret society of murder.
Yes.
They're after him. And that's all you need to know. Cause it starts off with killing. And then after that, there's killing.
And there's some travel.
There's some travel, and then there's some more killing.
Yes.
Then there's Halle Berry. And then there's dogs all mixed up in this as well. No, I'll just say it. This is a spoiler, but it's going to be helpful to people. No dog is killed in this movie. Now, in the first John Wick movie.
Yes, the inciting incident is the death of a dog.
The first thing that happens is they kill his dog.
Yeah.
And that, I really feel, is part of the appeal of these films. Because if you talk to people about what they don't want to see in a movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's an animal dying.
Have you ever gone to doesthedogdie.com?
No.
It's an actual website.
I know.
And for every movie, there's a pull-down menu that will tell you, like, you know, are there racial slurs?
Yes.
Is there homophobia? Is there, does glass cut human flesh? Like,
it
gets very specific of, like, things that people don't want to see.
Right.
But the site itself is called doesthedogdie.com.
Yeah. People don't want the dog to die.
No. Or the cat.
But if you start the movie with a cute little doggy being murdered, I think that inspires a bloodlust on the part of the audience.
Of course.
That can never be quenched. And so now we have
three movies in
of the story of a man who's on a rampage because they killed his dog.
He wanted out. He got out.
Yeah.
And then his wife died. Dying wife gives him the puppy. They kill the puppy, and it's on.
For three films.
Yes.
So that's this film is more killing, more fighting, more killing, more fighting, more killing, more fighting.
Yes.
I am perfectly satisfied by that. And here is... here is one of the things I love the most about it. We're still not at the library books yet. Because we're going to address your concerns
okay. When
we talk about the library books. There's a scene in, I guess this is Grand Central Station?
Yes.
People are stabbing, fighting, slicing, murdering each other. And no one pays any attention. It's like they're invisible. It's as though people in New York City are so...
Keep walking.
Are so used to...
I see nothing.
Anything going on that, like, you can have a brawl happening in the middle of Grand Central Station, and people are being stabbed and killed to death, and everyone is just sort of like, I gotta train. I can't be... Whatever's going on here...
Not my problem.
Not my thing. Yeah. This is not my gig. I gotta move. It's this bizarre little world where people are murdering each other in plain sight and no one cares. No one is watching.
I would say the majority of the killing takes place either in abandoned spaces or like in the Continental, you know, which is the assassin hotel.
Yes.
And that's the reason he's in trouble in this movie in the first place, because he killed somebody in the Continental.
Yes.
At the end of two.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. There is that moment when they're in the real world and it's New York. It's like, nah, blah, 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 I got nothing.
So the film opens with, for me, the best scene.
Yeah.
Where John Wick has to take a guy down in the New York Public Library. And not just in the library, like in the stacks.
Yes.
Like so. These little narrow walkways with lots of books. And he destroys this man with a book. The book is the weapon.
I mean, it's hardcover.
Yeah, it's not a paperback. Protracted fight scene, and the book is the murder weapon.
And also, they're being quiet because it's the library.
No. This was my one beef with that scene.
Oh, too loud.
They're not. It's too loud. There is a moment where someone is saying, like, someone says shit, but like, I think it's one of them that is saying it to the other. I can't remember now who does this, but like, it's much too loud. If it were me and I were in the library and dudes were trying to kill each other that way, I would be like, hey, you take that outside. This is a library. No.
At least take it out of general reference.
Yeah. We need to be quieter. If you're going to murder each other, please respect other people who are trying to work.
Did you not see Ex Libris?
Yeah, exactly. I would like to direct your attention to the Frederick Wiseman documentary about the institution that you are currently defiling. Yeah. With your blood vengeance.
But no, okay, so my thing about this movie is that I think that the pacing is off because it's so front-loaded. The first three big scenes that happen, it's the library fight scene, then it's the antique store with like a million knives in it.
Yes.
And then it's the horseback fleeing from motorcycles on the Brooklyn Bridge. Like, bam, bam,
bam.
They
make the horses kick people? That's
also great. Yeah. So really four sequences right there that are all amazing. And it's like, at some point the movie has to then get on with itself, but it's already jazzed you up so much that, I mean, yes, obviously you want to take a breather. There are peaks and valleys in this kind of movie, but there were stretches of it in the middle where I was kind of almost feeling like, oh, this is getting boring, which is not a thing I usually feel about a John Wick movie. And then by the time they get back to the Continental and he's duking it out with the two guys from the raid and they're in the Hall of Mirrors and all that stuff, I was like, okay, we're back. But I think there's a sag in this film that, you know, and much of that sag has to do with the fact that I don't really care about the story.
Well,
and about the high table and the plotting and all that stuff.
Here is the problem within the universe here. There is a bit of a sag in the middle. You're right. And it goes on for a little too long. Because without characters that you truly care about. And even John Wick is a bit of a cipher.
He's more of a concept.
Without characters that you care about, all you're there for is to watch the fighting. Now, that's enough for me. I love the fighting. I love the fighting, I love the shooting, I love the stabbing, I love the kicking. The bludgeoning. And there are some nasty, brutal deaths.
Yes.
In this film that made an audience full of, well, let's just say it, dudes, and more dudes at the West Hollywood Sunset 5 AMC. It made them all go, oh! You know?
Right.
So if super violence is not your thing, you don't want to go to this.
This is a hard R.
But super violence is my thing. Therefore.
There's nothing I object to in the content of the violence. But I don't know. I just, I could feel myself losing my enthusiasm, and I could feel the energy kind of draining out until it would then perk back up again.
The energy of the film is what keeps me invested because I... Like you, I do not care about these people or what happens to them.
You know, and they do sort of like keep the supporting cast interesting. You've got, you know, Ian McShane again. We get Halle Berry. We get Angelica Houston. We get Asya Kate Dillon. So, you know, there is that. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm telling people don't go see this movie. See this movie. I think it's being a little over... praised because we, the culture, the people,
we want this vigilante, which is what he is.
Yeah.
We want this vigilante to win against the bad people.
Right.
And so, you know, we're in a helpless world right now. If you look around and you see every hideous thing that's going on.
Moral absolutes start looking more attractive.
Like the thought of, what if I could just take these people down with a library book? What?
And not just metaphorically.
And not just, yeah. And not just shout at the bad people on Twitter.
Right.
You know, what do I want? Do I want to just yell at Mitch McConnell on Twitter, or do I really want someone to take him out? I will not answer that question on the microphone, but movies like this satisfy your desire for quick, efficient, and mean.
Ruthless.
Justice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the reason that they exist, and that's the reason why, you know, they don't have to be good movies. And I will say that the first John Wick film not only surprised me with its, like, sort of delight in its own violence, but with the care in terms of, you know, the filmmaking. There is an almost, like, ballet quality to the choreography in the first John Wick. You know, the way people move, the fight choreography, you know, the clever visuals of it, that each successive film now is, there's been a bit of a diminishing return on that stuff. So while I'm enjoying this third installment, the first one is still the best one.
I agree.
The first one's the one that takes you by surprise. The first one that that is the one that you can point to and say, this is cool filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's doing something a little different. But the thing is, these movies aren't sort of building the world that much.
Not really. They've got a little contained world and they're going to stay there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fun if you love The Raid to see the guys on The Raid pop up. But if you love The Raid, you're watching this and thinking,
well, it's not The Raid.
It's not as good as The Raid.
Yeah. Or The Raid 2.
Or The Raid 2. Yeah. But still, satisfying.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm happy.
And I would say, between the way this movie ends and the way that it opened theatrically, we will be getting John Wick 4.
Of course. and well, this film sets up a John Wick 4.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
The ending of the movie is...
And I only had to move my seat once in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah, because of the...
Phone?
The phone situation, yeah. But the guy saw me move.
Mm-hmm.
And he did this. He went, oh. And I was like, well, did you forget that you're in public? Like, what are you? And then, and I thought to myself after I moved, he better not come up to me after and like apologize or something. Because I didn't say anything to him.
Sure, no. But he was chastened nonetheless.
My new thing is not to
ever
not engage anymore. Like I'm a fat 55-year-old man. Well, I'll be 55 on June 7th. Happy birthday to me. I'm a fat middle-aged man. I don't need to have a heart attack or a stroke getting all furious at people with the phones anymore. I'm just going to get up and move. I go to the movie theater now. I pick the seat I want to sit in, and then I scope out my alternate seat. So like 3 minutes into the movie, I'm looking around for plan B, and if it comes to it, I'll just go to plan B. Mm. But yeah, because someone's going to be an a-hole on their phone. Always. It's life. That's life now. Someone is going to be an a-hole with their phone.
Alas, yes.
Yeah. And you can't actually John Wick them for it, even though it is what they deserve. Are you that person? Are you the person who thinks you're alone in the theater when you're not and you're using your phone? Guess what you are? An a-hole.
I have an e-book in my phone. Could I use that?
And you deserve the fate of a John Wicking. How about that?
Yeah, I really didn't like it. Every time Keanu Reeves would kill somebody, he goes, you just got wicked. that doesn't really
happen.
Don't
give them any ideas. Because some screenwriter will be like, yeah, no, that's part four.
They're not going
to
do
that. Oh, come on. Look what they did to the Rocky movies.
Well, yeah.
Look how successively more insane those got. But if the Rocky movies had kept going in the way that they were going, you would have had him fighting, you know, like Freddy Krueger in space by the end of it.
Why not?
Yeah. The next film we're going to discuss is The Sun Is Also a Star.
Ooh, yes.
Why don't you talk about that
movie? Okay. Well, it's based on a YA novel.
Called The Flower That Drank the Moon.
The poppy is also a flower.
This is directed by Rai Russo-Young.
Yes, who did the movie that we couldn't remember the name of about the girl who keeps dying over and over again until she gets it right.
Oh, yes. And what's that one called? That we keep forgetting.
I knew it, and then I forgot it again.
It's called Before I Fall.
Before I Fall, yes. Because I always get it confused with If I Stay.
Which, they came out around the same time.
Yeah.
And, well, she's right in her wheelhouse with this one, because this has a similar teenage vibe of the world is against me.
Right.
And I've got to figure out how to survive it.
And the woman who wrote the novel also wrote the book Everything, Everything.
I don't know that at all.
Which also got turned into a film. I want to say also starring Yara Shahidi, but I could be wrong. But the adaptation is by Tracy Oliver, who wrote Little and who wrote Girls Trip.
Yes.
So this
stars Yara Shahidi and Charles Melton.
Yeah. Amanda Stenberg was in Everything, Everything. Sorry. Yeah, Charles Melton, who is the second Reggie on Riverdale.
And Yara Shahidi, who was on Blackish and now
Grownish. Who I remember writing about how great she was in this terrible Eddie Murphy movie called Imagine That.
She was the little girl.
She was the little girl in that.
That is correct.
Yeah, so she's a lifer, and she's quite good in this. The two of them, I think, have real, like, star chemistry. And
they
that's
do.
The best thing
very
this movie.
Pretty
they're very pretty
together.
Like the first
and separately.
The first shot of Charles Melton, he's like lying on his bed. It's like shirts open, abs on full display. It's like when they put Kate Beckinsale in the shower at the beginning of White Out because she's going to be wearing a parka for the rest of the movie.
Yeah,
it's like I got him. So they play two teenagers sort of at a crossroads. Her family is Jamaican. They are being deported. She is going to have to leave the country the following day.
Yes.
He is the son of Korean immigrants. They want very much for him to be a doctor, even though he does not particularly feel like doing it. And he has his interview with Dartmouth that day. They meet by happenstance. He is immediately smitten by her. He tells her that, you know, if she gives him a day, that he'll get her to fall in love with him, even though she doesn't believe in love because she's very science-minded.
And she has enough no boundaries to allow a complete stranger to just sort of tag along with her for the rest of the day.
Well, he did save her life.
She don't owe him anything?
I suppose.
Yeah.
But he looks like Charles Melton.
Thanks for saving my life. No, we're not dating now. that would be my first reaction. I really appreciate how you saved my life. Would you like to go to a bakery and have a piece of cake with me to celebrate me not being dead? And I'll treat.
And then we will never see each other again.
We're not, I repeat, we are not dating now.
Well, again, he looks like Charles Melton. So then they spend the day together, and it is very Linklater-y, you know. It
really is.
It's very much
only like dumb teen.
I was about to say, but with like a lot of fake depth. In fact, there was
fake
a
what
depth.
Fake depth.
There was a moment I forgot about this when I was watching that I forgot about later, but somebody on Twitter mentioned it. There are some conversations that are so dumb that it's like this is life itself.
Life itself. Yeah, yeah. No, and they're not just conversations that are dumb, but things they do that sort of defy
logic,
human behavior, and logic. Yeah.
This is such a movie New York.
It's, oh God, yes. But you know what? It's not a movie New York. It's more like real New York than any movie New York I've ever seen, because there are no white people in this New York.
That's true. There's no white people have speaking parts in this movie. I said on Breakfast All Day, it's the antithesis of a Woody Allen film.
Yeah.
Part is cool, but it's also New York where you can just spend the night in a park
and no
nothing
one murders
happens.
You. Yeah. You know what I got? Here's the thing about this pretty stupid movie.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely charming.
Well, yeah. And it's not for us.
And it's for 10-year-olds.
Yeah.
Because when you're 10, you can look at an 18-year-old and first of all think, adults.
They got it together.
They're so cool and grown up. And envy is the wrong word, because when I was 10 and I watched movies about older teenagers, I felt the same thing. But I do, I guess, always envy the ability to watch a movie when you were very young and love it and think it's super deep and meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And keep it with your heart.
Yes.
You know? In spite of how you'll watch it again 15, 20 years later in life and think, oh my God, why is everyone so stupid? But you won't care.
No,
right?
Because
you
will always
won't care.
You will always at least partially see it through your own 10-year-old eyes.
Yeah. So, you guys, are you in middle school? You gotta go see The Sun Is Also a Star.
Yes.
Because it's super charming and romantic.
Speaking of turning off your phones.
I know. After Ms. Turner left, I turned it on to check my messages, and then I forgot to turn it off.
Do you not know how to flick the thing on the side to make it not make the sound?
Yes.
Okay.
I know how to do things. Right. I'm going to do it.
Okay, fine.
I will.
Fine.
What even was I talking about before you derailed me?
If you're in middle school, you got to see this movie.
Because it's romantic, and it's charming, and, you know, it's about pretty people that you're totally going to grow up to be like.
And it's about some recognizable things of the world today, as far as, like, what it's like to grow up in an immigrant family, what it's like to deal with current immigration policy.
It would like to be more political than it can be, because it's just not that good. But it attempts to be progressive about immigration and the draconian politics of right now, without ever saying the name of he who must not be named.
Yes.
And but the upshot is Republicans are disgusting. And that's a fact of life.
The
movie gives you that without ever saying it.
The movie also wants to kind of like eat its cake and have it too when it comes to like, we want to go for the sad tearjerker ending, but we also want to go for the non-bummer ending. So we're just going to do both.
Now, nobody dies.
No.
Unlike in basically all other YA films that are made into movies.
No one dies.
YA books that are made into movies. No one dies. And so you don't get that great, oh my. The ones where people die, those are the best. Because death is super romantic and really cool. And if you died, everybody would be sorry.
And they'd really appreciate how great you are. Really,
they would appreciate how wonderful you are. So no one dies here, but you know, bad things happen, and they persevere, and they come out the other end, and they still love. What I'm saying is, it sucks. Go see it.
Yes.
Because
do you want to mention your favorite part?
Remind me.
The Crimson and Clover montage.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. That slipped right out of my head. I'm going to shift gears here and talk about the part of the film that isn't stupid or dumb, but is actually beautifully cinematic. Like a moment I carried with me out of the film, and just, it felt euphoric. This sequence, like, it felt to me like the movie it wishes it had been from start to finish, rather than the movie that it was for 3 minutes in the middle. They go to a karaoke bar, and he begins singing Crimson and Clover to her. But, you know, he's not a great singer. But then the actual song kicks in and takes over his vocals, and they kiss. And they kiss in a big close-up. So it's, both their heads are filling the whole screen. And then it becomes this fantasy sequence as they fall in love and they get older and they have a life.
They get married,
they have babies, they do all these things, and they play the whole song. And I could just feel like, I could just feel chills going up my arms and my back, and just, it was wonderful. It is a wonderful sequence.
I love that part. I also love, there's a sequence where, and this is almost like one of those moments in Casino where they explain to you how, like, Vegas works.
Yeah.
There's a part where they wind up at his parents' store, which happens to be a store that sells black hair care products.
They talk all about and how that came to be.
Yeah, yes. And she's like, what? And he explains why Koreans in America have sort of cornered the market on, like, wigs and black hair care. And it's a cool, like, little two-minute thing. Like, that's fascinating. I never knew that.
Yeah, so there's more than a couple, you know, sequences in this film.
But it's dopey.
To recommend it. But it is, they are enveloped in a
nougat.
In a gooey candy bar of dumb.
Yeah.
Can't say that I hate it, though.
Yeah, and if you are a 12-year-old of either gender, you should see it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Look. I won't begrudge anyone going to see it.
No.
No one gets killed with a library book either. So
there is that.
It's all about just smooching. So much
smooching.
Smooching. And terrible narration.
Most narration is.
The kind where Yara Shahidi, bless her heart, has to say things like, humanity. And mean it.
This is a movie that opens and closes with quotes from Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
It's that kind of film.
Yeah.
All right, let's chop through these because we need to let the people go.
Why don't we talk about We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and we'll talk about Shadow next week. No. You know what? No. Let's flip that. Let's talk about We've Always Lived in the Castle next week.
Okay, why?
Because we're running out of time.
Okay, fine.
And I the reason is because Shadow, the new film from Zhang Yimou.
Mm-hmm. I think it's Yimou.
Okay.
I think.
I assume I've been saying it wrong for 20 years. I apologize. I'm terrible with all the names. If you hear this podcast and you can get out to a movie theater to see this, please do. Don't wait for the television experience.
I say, We Have Always Lived in the Castle is streaming.
It's already streaming.
You can get it on iTunes or Amazon. We'll talk about it next week.
But Shadow is so visually spectacular that it really demands, if you're going to go, it demands to be seen on a nice big screen.
Okay.
Zhang Yimou, director of Hero, House of Flying Daggers. This is his latest. It is, you know, set in 3rd century China in a palace. A lot of palace intrigue, machinations of war, challenges to authority, insults to authority, you know, freedom fighters versus, you know, occupiers. Too much plot to give you in a little synopsis, but you should know that there is there's a subplot involving a body double who's living in a cave who has to go in and be the fighter. So there's a king, he's sort of, you know, a dick, and there is sort of an insult to the king's sister offered by the son of a general who offers who refuses the offer of an arranged marriage, but instead says to the king about the king's sister, no, I won't marry her, but she can be one of my concubines. So this, in conjunction with all the other palace intrigue that's going on around everybody, ultimately leads to a second half of the film where it is all-out war. And everybody has their own sort of plan for when the fighting starts. So and because it's so, you know, complicated, these relationships, that you just sort of know that the film is going to end with, you know, someone killing someone and then someone else coming in and killing someone and then someone else coming in and saying, no, it has been me the whole time and I'm going to now kill all of you.
Like, it's going to end like Hamlet, basically.
Yeah. What you really want from this, because you've seen these sorts of royal, you know, warlike films set in this era of Chinese history before. If you're a fan of, you know, martial arts films, this is the time of, you know, that they like to dig into. Yeah. But the reason you want to see this one is because the color palette is black and white and gray. The flashes of color that you see in this color film are human skin, blood. Everything else.
So it's the at long last love of martial arts
movies. It is, yes. Thank you. As a matter of fact, it is. The production design of this film is staggering. Oh, and it's always raining.
Oh well.
So all the fights, all the battles, all the sword play, all the death umbrellas.
Ooh, I've heard about these.
Umbrellas made of interlocking blades that just like zoom right out of the umbrella. That people also use to ride down hills, spinning around. Look, I'll go see this again with you just to be able to look at it again.
I would like to see it.
I'm going to kill this name, unfortunately. I apologize in advance. Hun Chu Koo, who works under the name DD, fight choreographer, director, who's responsible for the House of Blue Leaves sequence in Kill Bill Volume 1.
Oh.
This is the person doing the stuff in this movie.
The blade umbrella.
It's astonishing.
You know, it's funny because you introduced this segment talking about, you know, Zhang Yimou being the director of like House of Flying Daggers and stuff. And my go-to in my head is always still like, oh, he's the Raise the Red Lantern, like judo, you know, not one less guy.
90s art house.
Yeah. But he is also
emotional filmmaking. And there is emotional content in this film.
Right, what obviously. I was going to say, but he is also like this guy who makes these visually, you know, resplendent like martial arts sagas that are also character based.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, and there's so many characters here. I think of him the way I think of Kenneth Branagh in a way.
Interesting.
Sort of classically minded director.
Right.
With, you know, everything looks gorgeous all the time.
It can operate in a variety of genres.
Yeah, and sometimes it's also boring. But not here. Not here. I heartily recommend this. If it comes to your city, get yourself out to the theater, see it, because you will be knocked over by just the compositional, you know, aspects of it alone. Just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I definitely, it's only showing like at NoHo and Glendale, but I,
you know. No, it's at the Arclight.
Not anymore.
It was.
Well, there's been a Friday since you saw it, so things are different.
Well, hurry, y'all.
We're not going to, I didn't pull out letters because we had a guest today. And
I've got no letters. I've got no DVD. I've got nothing.
Fine.
You get nothing. You stole fizzy lifting drinks.
You bumped against the ceiling, which has to be washed and sterilized. All right. So we're just going to do our recs. Well, first, of course, we're going to remind you about our Patreon page.
Yes. Here's what happens. Do you like this show? I hope so. Hope you haven't turned it off by now. We have a Patreon situation. It's the Linoleum Knife Club. You can join the Linoleum Knife Club for as little as $1 per month. Are you rich? You can join the Linoleum Knife Club for $20 a month. Depending on what level you join at, you get things. You get the LKRX, which is a daily recommendation. You get LKTV, which is another podcast all about television. And The Bachelorette just started.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a lot to talk about there. You get Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a food podcast. We have no business hosting a food podcast. We're film critics, not food people. But we love to eat, and I'm always cooking, and that's why we're doing it. You get Linoleum Nights, where we talk about all the things that we would like to talk more about, but then it wouldn't be a film podcast, would it? politics, sex, religion.
Things.
Our favorite new pop songs, just whatever, anything we feel like talking about, that's what's on Linoleum Nights. You get items mugs,
shirts,
enamel pins,
things. Yeah. Monthly club hangouts where we all watch a movie together on Netflix and have a Google Hangout.
We just watched East of Eden together. Yes. It's a lovely Saturday night.
Once a month.
Intimately involved with us on the internet. Linoleum Knife, sorry, patreon.com/linoleumknife. That's how you get to it.
And you should.
Sure.
So
we've got content that we want to sell you.
We do.
And you should buy it.
Please buy it. and thank you to everybody who is already on our Patreon. You know, y'all rock. So, hey, check out all of our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to Bibbs and Whitney on their two podcasts, Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. And maybe they have more now. It's hard to, I can't even keep up. But
there's too much.
Check out their action on the Schmoes Network. Stuff. And, of course, check out the Schmoes Know. Dennis, anyone with Dennis Hensley, the comics canon, who, by the way, are currently doing a 3-issue-at-a-time recap of Watchmen. It's really great. And they're getting into stuff that I have know that comic book backward and forward, and I am learning new things. So if you've never listened to Comics Canon, go check that out. All Things Cozy, Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can follow this show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Linoleum Cast. Subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review, won't you? It does help people find the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Spotify and CastBox and Podbean. And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. His stuff lives over at Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. And once again, we're at patreon.com/linoleumknife for extras and goodies. We thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Until then,
I was going to say, are you gonna?
I don't always have to give you an until then, but I guess you need one.
Help me out here.
Until then,
goodbye.